Jack Stein and Spike O'Neill, Mr. Drag him into treatment, kicking and screaming. It's a long nickname you got there, Spike. Rolls off the tongue.
I just go with the initials. GTKAS.
There's a really interesting report here talking about downtown Seattle has more residents than ever. Spike, you got the fine details on this for us?
Yes, I do, my friend. So a record high, 104,000 residents now call downtown Seattle home. Downtown Seattle comprises of 12 neighborhoods from Soto to South Lake Union, accounts for just over 4% of Seattle's total area, but is now home to more than 40% of the Seattleites, according to Downtown Seattle's Association's 2003 economic report. Excuse me. Now, why it matters is because downtown Seattle has been slower to recover from the pandemic by some measures than most other U.S. cities. But a diverse and growing residential base could set the stage for more resilient than ever downtown. That's according to DSA spokesperson James Aceto.
So by the numbers, downtown Seattle's resident population has increased by 70% since 2010. According to the DSA, it's still trending up per the report. Said downtown had a record 55,639 occupied apartments last year. So this seems like it should be pretty good news, right? I mean, everyone's talking about downtown's dying, it's going away. But I mean, if I think about this though, Spike, one of the things that, again, I always have to be kind of concerned or call concern to something is that part of me thinks that with the amount of people that are downtown, plus the amount of homeless people who are downtown, it seems like kind of a recipe for disaster, right? More thefts, more violence, more, you know, whatever it is. So yeah, I think you have to look at it in two ways. One, more people are going downtown, but then also, is this going to cause an upsurge in crime overall? There are going to be more instances of people saying, I just can't do this anymore. I can't live downtown. It's interesting to look at how these numbers pan out, right? Maybe people are just becoming more optimistic about the Emerald City, right?
I think so. And according to Mayor Harrell's plan, his State of the City address, he understands that first off, crime is job one, making Seattle downtown safe before people will visit or let alone move in to downtown. Then taking these business situations, these office buildings, which are at less than 50% occupancy, it's 47% occupancy, and converting some of these into office/residential areas.
Yeah.
When you couple that with the number of people who already call downtown home and a prioritized job one to help, you know, address the crime issue in our city. They've got initiatives to hire more police. They're doing national recruiting. They're offering massive signing bonuses. They've expanded the possibility of who will be even considered to be a Seattle Police Department officer. I think they've got the right plan in place. I think this is fantastic news that we've already got more than we thought. And we've got an active plan to bring people back downtown.
So now that we've got the good news out of the way, because Spike and I hate good news, there's another story here from Danny Westney. It says, starts off by saying, I came in here kicking and screaming as Washington debates a stick for the drug crisis. So Danny writes, can people in the throes of drug addiction be coerced into going into treatment? Gregory Scott says he was. He says, I came in here kicking and screaming. That's what he said this past week at a King County courtroom. The county's drug court had its first in-person graduation ceremony in 3 years since the pandemic hit. And Danny wanted to go down and observe the court in action to weigh in whether it's a possible path out of the region's spiraling drug crisis. So Gregory Scott goes on to say that after multiple arrests and failed attempts at rehab, Scott got put on the spot. He's charged with a felony-level property crime, and he was given a choice, go through a roughly year-long drug treatment program or go to prison. Now, this is a diversion program, Spike, which we have talked about before. And you and I were lambasted, mostly you, because people love me, but people were lambasting the idea about drug diversion programs. And they were saying, well, they don't work, and they've never worked in the past, and so on and so forth. But what I think that they're missing now is that with these diversion programs, if you leave the rehab, it's not like the city or the region just kind of washes your hands.
Oh, well,
and says,
good luck. Yeah.
Oh, well, good luck. You go to jail, which is what we talked about. What was that, like 3 weeks ago, Spike?
Yeah,
and that
yeah.
one guy was like, this never works. This will never work again. And it's like, dude, did you not read the idea behind it? But this guy goes on to say, Gregory Scott goes on to say, I have a long history of quitting. It's what he said told an applauding crowd in the courtroom. He says, I quit high school. I quit playing football. I quit on my family. I quit a bunch of jobs. Well, what I'm proud today is I quit using drugs and alcohol. So by completing the treatment, he said he's been sober for 30 months and he got his felonies canceled. I think this is the way the program should work, right? You have a set amount of time, you got to do all this stuff, and then you get a clean record. Well, this is the way that it works. This is the future, in my opinion.
And they had a UW professor, Caleb Banta Green, spoke to the state senators and said 80% of people with opioid addictions want to stop.
Yes.
Or reduce their use. This is for the other 20%. These are for people who aren't ready to stop. And like you said, Jack, you're looking at jail time. And it's not jail time for drug possession or drug use. Those are misdemeanors now. We're talking about felony criminal charges, mostly with the crimes people were using to support their drug habits, whether it's, you know, property theft, car theft, armed robbery, things like that. So they're asking the people who don't even have a mind to get clean, you can either go to jail or go to rehab. And if you don't keep your nose clean, you're going to go to jail. They used to give people a choice between jail and the army. Remember when, I mean, in the 70s, you know, how many people my father told me about that, you know, got in trouble with the law. You can either go to jail or you can enlist. Well, you know, this is a pretty similar scenario, but what we're trying to give people here, as opposed to a one-way ticket to Southeast Asia, is a better life.
That's such a bad way to put that.
Well, I mean, that's what guys were faced with.
Oh,
you know, you
that,
can enlist or you can go to prison. Now it's like, look, we understand you're only cutting catalytic converters off cars to feed your habit. Do you want to keep doing that or do you want to try to get clean? Because you're going to jail for property theft.
Andrew, can we get a ding sound effect, like a bingo sound effect, every time I start a sentence by saying, you know, Spike, when I was a drug addict, for all the people out there that are playing Jack Stein bingo, because we have listeners that play Jack Stein bingo that every time I talk about my old band or drug addiction or, you know,
buying guitars, another one.
Buying guitars.
the dealer in your driveway. That's a popular. Yeah, there you go.
Every time. So I just need everybody who's playing Jack Stein bingo to know. So what was this? Like 2 weeks ago, Spike, I said the same thing. Every drug addict that I know, every opiate addict that I know, they don't want to keep using opiates. They don't like it. They want to get off of it. They just don't know how to do it. And a lot of people get really uncomfortable when I say that. And they go, well, that's just anecdotal, Jackson. I think people want to believe that most of these people are dead set, for lack of a better word, of maintaining their drug addiction, because that's what they're largely shown in the media. But the guys that I talk to, guys, email me. I know I've said this before, but I'll say it again. I'm a semi-public figure, so I often get emails from people or DMs on Twitter, whatever it is, people saying, I'm trying to get sober. I don't know how to do it, right? This is a very frequent occurrence here. Now, I would say some of these guys are just looking for me to validate their drug addiction, which is a weird kind of occurrence. Like, so basically what they do, Spike, is they say, I'm freebasing heroin. I don't know how to stop. And then I reply back and I go, okay, well, where do you live and where are the rehabs in your area? And then they go, well, my back hurts and I don't know if I can do my job if I don't have heroin. And then I go, okay, well, where are the rehabs in your area? And then they go, yeah, I can't go to rehab right now because I have my job. And I go, okay, well, where are the rehabs in your, you know, there are guys out there that will look for any excuse. But most of these guys, when I say, where are the rehabs in your area? They go, I have no idea. So I do a Google search for them and we look it up and we figure out how to get them into that program. And it's a really special thing. But I think that people live in a fiction when it comes to their perception of drug addicts at large, where the stats on this is very clear. The vast majority of people who are heavily addicted to substances do not want to do it anymore. They just don't know how to stop. Now, if it was me, what did I do, Spike? I mean, I just flat out stopped doing drugs. I didn't go to rehab. I didn't do the 30-day program, 60-day program, 90-day program. I just went to the hospital and I told the doctor, I said, I don't want to be addicted to drugs anymore. And she gave me some drugs so that I wouldn't have a seizure and sent me on my merry way. And I just kind of did the old basketball diaries. It's what we call it in the business. You familiar?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. White knuckle. Hang on for dear life.
Yeah. We just kind of. But it's really not that bad, Spike, to be totally honest. It's really. You have the flu for like a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks. Okay. And then you're fine. Yeah. Unless you're doing something heavy like benzodiazepines, and in which case you should probably do, you know, medically assisted treatment. But for opiate addiction in particular, or cocaine addiction, methamphetamine, for me, it was just like I had done it. So I had kicked so many times that at that point in time, it was like, whatever. Do you know what I mean? The thing you have to do is plan your life for when you come out of that cycle of withdrawal. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
you have to be able to have forward plans there. So you know what you're going towards, because otherwise you know, after that 7 or 10 days, you're going to say to yourself, well, I'm good now. I'll just go down to the bar and kick back a couple of tall boys and some Cuddy, and I'll have myself a regular evening out with the boys, and then you find yourself doing cocaine in Carbone's bathroom.
Well, now this program, again, it's Danny Westney wrote this article for the Seattle Times about whether or not the state should use, you know, forced rehab
to help
not a cure or end our addiction problem, but use it as one more tool to address our state's addiction problem. And I believe it's a year long program.
Yes.
If I'm not mistaken. So it's not like 28 days where most rehab in, you know, 30 days in, you know, on site rehab facilities, they'll get you clean and kick you free. And to your point, you have to have a plan after you get clean. Well, with a year of either staying clean on this thing for a year or going to jail, you will force yourself to make a plan.
Yeah, and so I my former partner used to work at an outpatient rehab, and so they had several different programs. You got a 30-day program, you have a 90-day program, you have a 120-day program, you have a 240-day program. Overwhelmingly, the people that went to the 90, to the 120, or the 240 did better than the people who just went to the 30-day program.
Sure.
Overwhelmingly. So in my mind, as much as we like to think about our freedoms and we're in America and you can't tell me what to do, if I was an iron-handed dictator, if I was the benevolent dictator of the fine United States, I would just throw people in treatment. There's not a question about it. I would just say you can't handle it. You can't function. You got to go to treatment. I know that people hate that idea, but I am of the mind that some of these people that I see out on the streets, these are people who can't take care of themselves. These are people who can't make decisions for themselves. These are people who can barely, you know, put on clothes, let alone stand up straight. That, in my mind, is the kind of person that there's no question you get thrown in rehab. I understand people out there who are kind of hesitant about that. And they're saying, well, I don't want the state to come in and mandate rehab for people. And my response to them will be, well, what is the alternative? What is the alternative for that person who can no longer take care of themselves?
Right? Jail? Because that's where they're going to go. That's where these folks are going to go.
Yeah, where they're going to get drugs. Right.
I mean, they're not going to get clean in jail.
No. So there's a way to do this, and I would do mandatory treatment for people. Go ahead.
You have to have a back end plan, though. To your point, you have to have a plan after you're clean. I mean, it's one thing to say, okay, we're going to put you in a year long rehab program to keep you out of jail, but there's got to be, and there already is. There are systems in place to help people who want to seek help. And I think you're right. 80% of the people want to quit using, right? And 20% are forced to quit using. I mean, if once you get them clean and you say, here, there are systems in place to help you become the person you should be and become an active, contributing member of society.
Yes.
And if they're clean, I mean, you've been telling people who are addicted about these opportunities and about this support, but they just couldn't get to it because they were still using. You get them through that forest, then maybe they can take the help.
Yeah, and also for people who might say, you know, well, Jack, I don't think that mandatory treatment is a good idea. There's another article here from the Seattle Times talking about how the downtown light rail stations have basically completely and totally fallen apart. I totally agree with the author of this, talking about how, you know, you've got to sidestep broken escalators and fentanyl smokers outside of the entrances. And it's just like these are the kinds of things where you solve the drug crisis and you move that out of the way. And then I believe this would be my theory, that everything else just kind of falls into place, which is why I would be, you know, King Jack sending people to rehab who don't want to go kicking and screaming. And I would say it's for the good of the land is what I would say.
Well, I mean, you want to cure homelessness in the city, you know, help attack the drug problem. You want to help cure crime in this city? Attack the drug problem.
Right.
You want to clean up the downtown rail stations? Attack the drug problem.
Right. This is my thought. You know that guy? That guy? I forget his name. The really reprehensible individual. The guy who threw the nurse down the stairs.
Yeah. I don't recall his name either. But I know exactly who you're talking about.
Right.
The guy that we had to pay $64,000 to because they couldn't find. He was deemed mentally incapable to stand trial, so he was in a jail while they waited to find him a bed.
Right. So my thought about it is that you have people who are that mentally ill, who are also able to get their hands on substances. Usually stimulants is the easiest, you know, drug to access. Yeah. And so then you are in a public space like the light rail station, And what do you do with the voices in your head and the methamphetamine telling you that you have to let everybody know that, you know, Jodie Foster is sending you messages about how you have to paint the walls, right?
Right.
So in my mind, that guy probably would have benefited from forced mandatory treatment. And that instance would have never happened, right? If someone had the courage of their conviction to be able to just take people off the streets who can't deal with it and put them in a mandatory rehabilitation center, right?
Right.
So that's what I mean about avoiding these kinds of things.
No, I hear you. His name was Alexander J.
It was
$63,000. Now, that's another issue, too, because, I mean, here's a guy that was supposed to be going to hospitalization because of his mental state. He was kept in a county jail while the city was looking for a bed for him in a hospital situation. So the $63,000 was a fine that the city was paying to him. It was a punitive incentive to get off their backs and find him a hospital bed as opposed to just leaving this guy in jail. And we've all got constitutional rights, even a dirtbag who threw some lady down the stairs. He's obviously not mentally well.
Sure.
And he has the right to be cared for in a health capacity as opposed to just locked down in jail, as was the case with him. So what happens? Who's got the 63 grand? Is that his money? Are we sitting on that money to do restitution to his victims, help offset the cost of his care? I mean, I'm curious as to what happens to 63 grand. The thought of paying this guy 63, I understand there's a constitutional obligation to give people what they are constitutionally entitled to, health care for the sick, jail for the criminal.
Sure.
But 60, the 250 bucks a day? $63,000 this guy now has?
Yeah, my assumption, and if anybody knows otherwise, I'd really like it if you could text in and let me know. My assumption is that because he does not have any assets, that is going to go towards the treatment center, right? Because that money's got to come from. I don't think they're going to put it in an escrow account and say, you know, we're going to let this appreciate over time. He doesn't have anything. Now he's got 60K. Yeah. Now he's got to be at the hospital. Someone's got to pay for it, and I think they're going to take that. At least that's my guess. Or he'll get sued by the woman that he nearly killed, and she'll get that. That would be my assumption. I'm not sure, though.
I would hope so.
But, I mean, this is the way to, as unfortunate as it is, once you reach a critical mass point with the light rail or just people in the street or whatever it is, I think once you reach that critical mass point, you have to start making decisions that maybe make people a little uncomfortable, like saying, you got to go to treatment. You don't have any other options. We're taking you off the street and you're going to be done, right?
Well, you're going to directly affect the people who are causing the problems that you complain about every day of your life. You keep complaining about these problems and we want to do something, but oh, heaven forbid, we can't sweep any homeless encampments out. We can't force anybody into rehab.
You
want solutions. Sometimes solutions come with a little bit of discomfort, especially for those who are the ones who are causing the problems that we all want to see addressed.
We had a very heated pre-show meeting debate in which Spike O'Neill accosted verbally one Chris Martin over what, you may ask? What could possibly cause
I buy Spike the guy O'Neill. A nose trimmer and he just ignores the hint. I mean, how much am I supposed to take?
Right. So the article that was brought up, it's a fairly innocuous article here from Yahoo News saying censorship or evolution, sensitivity readers divide the publishing world. Now, this is where it gets heated. It's a profession which is increasingly under the spotlight as the culture wars rumble on. Sensitivity readers, editors who identify insensitivities or stereotypes in manuscripts are becoming a lightning rod for the publishing industry. So the idea is that they will go through a book and they will censor it. Now, Spike O'Neill in the red corner says that this is perfectly acceptable because we should not be exposing children to difficult words or difficult ideas, difficult concepts. Whereas Chris Martin, being very based and very, what do you want to call it? Not cringe.
I feel so fairly represented, Your Honor.
Chris Martin, being very based and book-pilled, said that the book should be left alone unless the author themselves wants to make the changes to them. Is this correct from both parties?
Yes. I would say for me, yes.
Yes.
But, and very good. We're talking about old books. Like I said in the meeting, I mean, publishers have always... gone through content and decided whether they wanted to put their name behind it or not.
Well, yeah,
right. So that's always happened.
Every book offered for publication is reviewed by editors. Now those editors have to look towards sensitivity as one of the deciding factors on what can stay in a manuscript prior to its publication. That's not a big deal. The conversation then turned to previous works that are being rewritten, you will. And I grabbed the easy example of Dr. Seuss. Mm-hmm. The Dr. Seuss books that were being edited by the Seuss Foundation, by the executors or the family of Dr. Seuss, of books written when cultural norms were much different than they are today. And that organization, the Dr. Seuss Foundation, decided it would be inappropriate to show kids books today with various stereotypical and someone could say racist images of Asians, of Africans, of from around the world. And these are little kids viewing these books. And the Seuss Foundation decided, look, we're talking about six books out of dozens and dozens and dozens. And we're talking about when they are published again in the future to take out these insensitive and stereotypical and often degrading images. Then we turn our talk to Ian Fleming about do you unmisogynize the James Bond books? And that's where we kind of got into a really a spirited disagreement.
You could say that you yelled at Chris and you threatened to fire him.
I threatened Chris's livelihood, his personal safety.
So, but the other thing that has been brought up is I've never been able to pronounce his name correctly. Roald Dahl. Talking about how they're going to go through books like Boy or his other, the witches or whatever it is, and they're going to remove certain words like fat or crazy.
Right.
No longer going to use those descriptive terms in those books. And Fleming's books are going to be reissued with racial references removed. So the problem with this, though, is that we want to have the original works for people to no one would ever think to do this to Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens. No one would ever think to do this to, let us just say, W.E.B. Du Bois, right? No one would ever think to do this to someone like Frederick Douglass. We would not go back. We would not retcon what they said because they said uncomfortable things in their speeches or in their writing or whatever it is. But for some reason, because it's Dr. Seuss and because he has some unflattering images in there, people think that it's okay. I think that that's simply bizarre. And you know who agrees with me on that is Whoopi Goldberg, because many years ago, Warner Brothers released a collection. I believe it was the Criterion collection of cartoons. And she came out and she had something that I thought was very profound to say about what children were going to see in the collection of the Warner Brothers cartoons. Here's what that
sounded like. The Looney Tunes and their irreverent brand of humor are products of their time. Unfortunately, at that time, racial and ethnic differences were caricatured in ways that may have embarrassed and even hurt people of color, women, and ethnic groups. Now, nobody intended it, but that's what happened. Now, some of the cartoons here reflect some of the prejudices that were commonplace in American society, especially when it came to the treatment of racial and ethnic minorities. Now, these jokes were wrong then, and they are wrong today. But removing these inexcusable images and jokes from this collection would be the same as saying they never existed. So they are presented here to accurately reflect a part of our history that cannot and should not be ignored.
Based and whoopee-pilled right now is what I am. Based.
And that's saying something, because there aren't a lot of examples where we can point to Whoopi Goldberg for the sound of reason.
Right. And so, but that is why it's so important to leave these books the way that they are, right? Is so that people understand the context in which they are written. No one would think to do this to Kill a Mockingbird,
right,
or to A Raisin in the Sun or to Native Son, any of these very important texts from that period of time. If you were to go back and redo the art of the men and women of the Harlem Renaissance, you would effectively be erasing them from existence. No one would want to do that. And we shouldn't do it to Dr. Seuss in the same way that we shouldn't do it to Warner Brothers cartoons or Mark Twain, in my humble opinion.
Well, what's worse? Let me ask you this question, because this is what we're talking about in real time in today's America.
Yes.
Is it worse to take Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird and alter it so it's not as offensive, or to ban it altogether from a public library?
So, yeah, and this is where I think it's worse to ban it altogether, right?
But different people are thinking that. That's coming from two – that's not one or the other because that's two different camps.
No, I understand that. I'm not trying to conflate the two. But what's happening in real time is that books are – which are deemed offensive to a certain population of our country, of various states, are being banned from books. Parents now have the right in many states to just arbitrarily submit a list of books they feel is inappropriate for their child to have in a school library. And those books are being pulled from libraries.
But all that does is bring, as we all know, brings more attention to the book than ever before.
Right, yeah. Well, did you know that when Dr. Seuss announced that they were going to pull all the copies of that book, sales of that book went through the roof. I mean, people were paying $5,000 or $6,000 for that book on eBay.
I sold mine for that. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I understand that folks will still get to see these works of literature, that folks will still have value in these pieces of work. But the fact that school boards and state governments are telling parents and parents are telling their children that this book is inappropriate for you, that's my trouble. It's not that kids won't be able to see them. The parents of the kid who thinks it's a good idea to ban To Kill a Mockingbird from the school library or Tom Sawyer from the school library isn't going to then go and buy him a copy of it
to
read.
You shouldn't change the book itself or the work itself because that's what the author meant. And maybe the author was playing a racist character or whatever it was. It doesn't mean the author you meant that. And it doesn't matter if they did or didn't. That's what the work is.
You know, we're in agreement. When we started this conversation today, it was about, you know, specifically Dr. Seuss's foundation decided that they didn't want to keep putting out books with those images in them. That was the main thrust of my argument. I think that books that can be found offensive because of the period in which they were written, the social norms of that era, should have disclaimers, not alterations, not removal of key elements of the story, because it told a history of a time in our history. It told, you know, what it was like for Americans in that era. And it's important that kids know that if it's uncomfortable, it's uncomfortable. Be warned. Make it age appropriate. Kids are a lot smarter and savvier than we often give them credit for. Kids can handle things we often try to protect them from because it's a dangerous world. I get it. Protecting your kids is paramount as a parent. But kids can take a little racial insensitivity when in context, explain to them this was life for your great-grandparents in America.
I was just thinking about what if Rush Limbaugh's estate suddenly decided that they wanted to go back through his catalog of 30 years of broadcasting and cut out everything that they thought was inappropriate.
That'd be 37 minutes of the best radio you'll ever hear.
Spring break. Now unfolding across the nation. And unfortunately, headline after headline after headline is nothing but violence and death and destruction, and it's really quite very sad. I actually saw a video spike on Twitter this morning. It was a group of kids in Miami, and so there's a cop car, and there's got to be, I don't know, maybe a couple hundred kids around this cop car, and these kids go, spring break, and they jump on top of the cop car. And they start jumping up and down, and then the cop says, well, I'm going to get out of here. So he starts driving. And in the fine state of Florida, as it has been law for the last 2 years, if you are in the middle of a protest like that or a riot like that and people touch your car, you are allowed to drive through them without having to worry about the legal ramifications of that. So needless to say, Spike, it looks pretty bad. Every time I see one of these spring breaks, here's another one, Miami Beach, sees a pretty hard crackdown. There's now a curfew, starts at midnight because there was a shooting earlier in the day on Friday, and then there was another one on Sunday. So now it looks like people who are going there for spring breakification are now going to have to go home at midnight, which is what I have suggested, by the way, just a call back to last week. I've said all bars should close at midnight. So.
Well, I feel for the city of Miami Beach. The mayor, Dan Gelber, says, look, as I've said many times, we don't ask for a spring break in our city. We don't want spring break in our city.
It's too rowdy.
Brings too much disorder, and it's simply too difficult to police. Yeah, Gerber notes that the shootings both involved tourists, not locals, and that the large disorderly crowds, in addition to the presence of guns, has created a peril that cannot go unchecked. And he's not alone. Every spring break town, whether it's down in the Texas coast, whether it's any part of Florida, you know, the Mississippi coast, Louisiana coast, all these spring break towns, these beach resort towns up along the Atlantic seaboard, You know, Arizona's the same way. Go to Lake Mead down in Arizona on spring break. People have just become emboldened. I hate to keep being a broken record. We're the worst version of ourselves. We're just empowered to be the worst, absolute worst version of ourselves.
I think something has happened to people where now we basically have a camera crew that follows us around at all times, right? We've got Instagram, TikTok, Facebook Live. I think something has occurred to people where they are able to film themselves doing stupid things. And there is a certain amount of, I don't know, machismo or braggadocio or some other Italian word I could throw in there. There's a certain amount of something that occurs which amplifies the situation because now there's a camera on you, right? And I'm going to get a piece of footage of me jumping on top of a cop car. It's going to be so great. And I don't think people realize, let us just say, the ramifications of those decisions as they're unfolding.
Well, what they're receiving is, you know, approval, encouragement. Hits.
Yes. Yeah,
validation from, I mean, you are literally like the guys, the Kool-Aid challenge, guys running through fences, destroying personal property, like the Kool-Aid guy. They're filming him committing a crime and getting hits on social media because it reaffirms their value in that community, where that community values, you know, notoriety over quality of individual. And you're right. That's probably as big a factor in who we see doing this stuff these days as it is, you know, unstable home life, lack of financial opportunity. It's ego.
Well, I'll tell you this, Spike. One of the reasons why I haven't really touched my YouTube channel in a couple of months is because I found, for whatever reason, when a video of mine would do really well, I was, you know, floating 2 inches off the ground. I was like,
that's a great feeling, cutting edge,
right? But then when a video would not do so well, it was like destroying my sense of self-worth. And I thought, well, is my content not as good, or is this bad? And the reality is, that's not the case. It's just sometimes the algorithm picks up a video, sometimes it doesn't. But I think there is something to be said about how people are being programmed in so many ways to seek out that validation. I mean, Spike, I put out a video that I was expecting to get at minimum 500 views in the first 24 hours. I think it got something like 75, and I was feeling so low. I was feeling so terrible. And I just thought, this is doing something to my brain. This is doing something to me where I got to get away from this and reevaluate the whole thing before I start making videos again, because this is just not good for me emotionally, right? But then you take somebody who doesn't do any editing, they don't do any production, they just hold the camera up vertically, which is the worst way to film yourself, and then they jump on top of a cop car and they get 10 million hits.
Right.
Compared to me, who puts 8 hours into a video and then 12 people are like, Jack, go away, we hate you, boo! And then I go, okay, what am I doing with my life, right?
We have a news article that talked about Miami Beach that we've been quoting about these shootings and the fact that spring breaks have become too uncontrollable and may become a thing of our past. You ever seen the movie, which Jurassic Park was it? I think it was the second one where Jeff Goldblum brings his teenage daughter along to Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
They got what they call a high hide, right? One of those things that's like an elevated, like a genie lift, kind of a crane.
Sure.
The police in Miami Beach have one of these to monitor the crowd. A high hide. We're talking about velociraptors as opposed to spring break teenagers. And that's the level of safety the police feel they need in this crowd.